So every summer, Stephanie and I will invite every family within our church who has school-aged children back to my parents' camp on Caledonia Mountain. It sits on Stanyard Lake. It's a beautiful lake for swimming and boating and paddleboarding, all that stuff. It's great. And in the last couple summers, we've had almost 40 people there, up to 20 kids kind of school age there, and it's been a blast. And normally, within a few moments of us arriving there, well, kids will hit the water, they'll go swimming, and without any prompting, there's a game that erupts on the raft. It's the same game that I played when I was back there when I was a kid. It's called King of the Raft. You're right. It's King of the Raft. I'm sure everyone here probably played that at one point. Essentially, the goal of this game is to push everyone off the raft while you manage to stay on it. It's a game of strength and power to see who's the strongest. And it's fun. And on the way back to our house, I will hear my kids say, "Did you see that? I pushed Cody off, or I pushed Dylan off, or take your pick." And I'm like, "Well, I saw that, but there's like five other people pushing them too." So I was, come on now. I share this with you, to ask, do you ever wonder where this desire comes from to be the strongest, to be the most powerful, right? To be the one who can kind of exert your will over someone else? So we're in like a 7 or 8 week stretch where we're considering a number of different human longings or desires or features that all of humanity shares in common, regardless of who we are or where we are from. And so far, we've talked about morality, that we all share a sense of right and wrong. We might not agree on that, but we all have a sense of right and wrong. We've talked about justice, that we all have a desire for justice. We might not agree on it, but we still have a desire for it. And today we're talking about power, that we all have a desire for power. And we're talking about these things, not simply for the fun of it. We're talking about them so that we can have a better sense of who we are, a better sense of who God is, and lastly, a better sense of God's good design for the world, which is revealed in His Son, Jesus Christ. And so for today, where does our desire for power come from? And this is something that all of humanity shares in common. How often will elementary school age kids speak of who can beat up who on the playground? Or maybe that was just me growing up, I don't know. And the ridiculousness of these conversations knows no bounds. They will go as far as saying, "Well, I bet my dad can beat up your dad." I remember the school calling home once when Grace was in grade 3. There was a boy in grade 5 that said something to her that she didn't like, and she responded with something to the effect that her dad would kill him. I guess the school frowns on that kind of thing. Anyway, this desire for power is present in us very early, and it continues on throughout our life. It's the teenage girl who leverages their social status to influence and to make others feel smaller. It's the husband who physically abuses his wife to gain control over her. It's the wife who has her own means of getting her husband to do exactly what she wants him to do. It's the first time you own a home and the sense of joy that you have when you think this land is yours to do with whatever you want. It's the business owner who revels in their position above their employees. It's the leaders of countries who boast about taking control of other countries, like China over Taiwan, like Russia over Ukraine, like the United States over Greenland, or Canada, or the Panama Canal, take your pick. We humans have a desire for power. Where does it come from? And the answer here, albeit perhaps slightly surprising, is no different than what we discussed in previous weeks about where we gain our sense of morality or justice from. We gain this from God himself. God is all-powerful. He is the creator of the world. Isaiah 40, 28, the Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. Jeremiah 32, 17, ah, sovereign Lord, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. Nothing is too hard for you. Right? God throughout our scriptures is always portrayed as all-powerful, omnipotent. And we are made in his image. Genesis 1, 27, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. So our desire for power and position over other aspects of God's creation is something that we've gained from God himself. It's hardwired into us. It's part of this image of God imprint that we have. And I understand that this might, you know, cause us to feel a little awkward because we rarely speak of anything like this, right? That our desire for power comes from God, because we normally associate with power with more evil and darkness in the world. But there is no mistaking that this is part of this image of God that we bear. Right, consider the verses in Genesis 1:28. Said, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Or in Psalm 8, 6 to 8, said, you made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds and the animals of the wild, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas. And if you push into passages that speak of the new heaven and new earth, right, that God is going to create where evil is no more, this idea of power and ruling is still present there. Revelation 5:10 states, you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. Or 2 Timothy 2:11 and 12, if we died with him, we will also live with him. If we endure, we will also reign with him. So our desire for power and influence, it's not some evil aspect of our soul. It's actually a reflection of the one in whose image we've been created. And so this begs the question, why does our God-imprinted desire for and use of power produce so much evil in the world? Right? If this is a feature of God that has been hardwired into us, why does it seem like the vast majority of evil in the world stems from it? And at this point, you know, after a few weeks here having these kind of discussions, I hope you could provide the answer, right? When discussing morality, we learn that our sin nature corrupts our sense of right and wrong. When discussing our desire for justice, we learn that our sin nature corrupts our understanding of it and our execution of it. And it's no different with power. Our sin nature corrupts our understanding of it and our use of it. And it's somewhat fascinating in this discussion in particular, because we could rightly say that our sin nature has power over us. Both Jesus in John chapter 8 and Paul in Romans 6 speaks of us being slaves to sin. That it controls an awfully lot of what we think and what we say and what we do. And it never influences us in good and healthy ways. It always directs us into courses of action that are at odds with God's good design, that are at odds with the flourishing of human life. Our life under sin is often referred to in our scriptures as a kingdom or dominion of darkness. And I know we've covered this territory before in recent weeks, but for anyone who is new this morning, this sin nature is something that we acquired from our first parents, from Adam and Eve. When they disobeyed God in the garden, this sin nature was a consequence. Now each person gains it. Each person suffers from it. And it corrupts every aspect of this image of God imprint that is present in us. And it corrupts our desire for and use of power in horrific ways. If I were to attempt a summary of our sin-corrupted understanding of and use of power, it is that we are convinced that real power is demonstrated by exerting our will on others, normally by the use of force. It's the kid on the playground who enforces his will by using his fists. It is the husband who physically abuses. It is the wife who manipulates. It is the world leader who will use economic or military force to accomplish their will. This is our sin-corrupted understanding of and use of power, and the devastation that it brings into the world knows no bounds. And no one escapes this corruption that sin causes. Think of Jesus' own disciples here. Right? When the guards show up to the Garden of Gethsemane to arrest Jesus, what does Peter do immediately? Right? He grabs his sword. That's his knee-jerk reaction, cuts the guy's ear off. He wants to enforce his will on those who show up to arrest Jesus. Or James and John, in response to Samaritans who did not welcome Jesus into their village, do you know what they say to Jesus? Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them? Right? That's their knee-jerk response. They want to enforce their will on those Samaritans that would not welcome them. Or another example with James and John. They're the ones who request to sit at the right and the left hand of Jesus in his kingdom. And they are looking for power and influence under this sin-corrupted understanding of power. They want to be able to enforce their will on those around them, just as the rulers of their day did. So if Jesus' own disciples don't escape this corruption, what hope do we have? What hope does the world have? Is there any chance that we have our image of God imprint as it relates to power and everything else for that matter? Is there any chance that it might be fixed or restored or made whole or redeemed? And the answer is yes. The solution is found in the person of Jesus Christ. He is the solution to everything. And I want us to turn to how Jesus offers this redemption, this salvation. And first, Jesus offers us a proper understanding of how power and strength is supposed to be used in his kingdom. And we'll look at this from two different angles. First, when Peter draws his sword in the Garden of Gethsemane to protect Jesus using force, Jesus will have none of that. He says, "Put your sword back in its place, for whoever draws the sword will die by the sword." Like, it's a complete rejection and condemnation of our sin-corrupted understanding of and use of power. This is not ever how it's intended to be used. And if we do, we've missed the mark. This is sin's influence. And the dialogue in the text continues. Jesus says, "Do you think I cannot call on my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" It's as if to say, if I wanted to use force to accomplish my will, I easily could. But that's not how we do things. And so this text is more of a condemnation of our typical understanding of and use of power. It doesn't actually really give us instruction about its proper use. But the text where James and John ask to sit on the right and left of Jesus in his kingdom, Jesus does provide clear instruction on this front. Following their request, Jesus gathers all the disciples together and he says, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Right? He compares and contrasts these two different ways of using power and strength. The rulers and officials of this world lord it over others. They use their power to enforce their will. And this is the opposite of how Jesus would have us live if we're to be his followers, if we're to live in his kingdom. Right? You want to be great, powerful, influential in the world, you serve others. You put the interests of others above your own. Not only is this Jesus' formal instruction, it's the example that he actually sets for us. Right? Jesus Christ, the creator of the world, the one who could call upon 12 legions of angels to enforce his will, comes into the world to serve, to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus provides us a clear picture of how we should understand and use our power and influence in the world. It's the complete opposite of what our sin-corrupted understanding of power would suggest, but it's the only way that leads to life. And the implications here are many. Like, we could talk about them all day. In your relationships, husbands, use your strength and your power and your influence to serve your spouse, to serve your children. Wives, the same thing. Use your power and influence to serve your husband and your children. Operate the same way with your colleagues and your neighbors, your employer, your employees. This is how we live in the world if we are a follower of Jesus Christ. This is the part that we play in kind of properly restoring this image of God imprint in us that's been corrupted by sin. Providing clear instruction about our understanding of and use of power, it's not the only way that Jesus provides salvation on this front. Remember, our sin nature actually has power over us. We are slaves to it, which means even if we had perfect instruction, which we do, which we receive from Christ, we still won't be able to follow through on it. Well, thankfully, Jesus' salvation is far more encompassing than just good instruction. And I want to read some verses to help us here. Romans 6:18. It simply states that you have been set free from sin. A few verses later in Romans 6:22, it repeats the claim. But now that you have been set free from sin. Or in Colossians 1:13, it says, "For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves. Or 1 Peter 2:9, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Jesus affords us the opportunity to be set free from sin, to come out from under its power, to be transferred from sin's dominion of darkness to God's kingdom of light. This is what Jesus was referring to when he said that he'd come into the world to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And we're not going to get into the details of it here this morning, but we need to understand that Jesus, through his death, affords us the opportunity to move toward freedom from sin, right? To come out from under its power, which means Jesus not only provides us clear instruction regarding our understanding and use of power, he provides us with the real possibility of actually beginning to live this way. Week after week, right, we arrive at the same conclusion. Jesus Christ is the solution. He is the Savior to everything that ails us. And if we come to him, if we trust him and follow him, we'll begin to move toward becoming the men and the women that he designed us to be. We'll begin to restore this sin-corrupted image of God that is imprinted upon us. And so as individuals, as a church, I hope we live in obedience to Jesus Christ, not just because we know this is where life to its full is, but I hope we live in obedience to Christ because we'll end up pointing other people to the solution that Jesus is. I'm going to invite you to join with me in song, and we're going to sing a song titled Trust in God.